And those of you who are coming week by week, I hope you're familiar now with the theme of 1 Corinthians. It has a lot to do with unity in the church. Today we come to, I suppose, not just the most famous chapter in 1 Corinthians, but maybe for some people the most famous chapter in the whole Bible, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And it too fits in with that central theme of unity within the people of God. So I'm going to read that now. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Have you ever wondered where the stars go during the daytime? Of course, you're educated people, I was forgetting. You know the answer to that, don't you? The stars are there all the time, aren't they? It's just that when the sun is risen, it's so bright, they pale into insignificance and can no longer be seen. At Corinth, the Christians were arguing. It was a little bit as though the stars in the sky were rivaling one another as to which was the brightest. Not content with their God-given luminosities, they were turning the whole thing into a competition. If you were here last week, you'll remember that in chapter 12, Paul does address this matter. He does so by trying to tell them, look, the church is a body, and every individual Christian is a kind of limb or organ in the body. Everybody's important. Everybody has a role to play. Everybody's different. That's the way it is with bodies. It's not appropriate that you rival one another. But obviously he didn't feel that argument on its own was enough. He has an additional one to give us, what he calls here the more excellent way. In chapter 13, he puts the sun in the sky. "You're also eager to be the brightest star," he says. "Well, I'm going to show you a star, a gift of the Holy Spirit, which is so bright it swamps all the others. A star that makes your pretentious glories look like dim, glimmering glowworms. The gift of love. Without love," he says, "you're all a load of nothings. Love is the sun, which once it has risen, makes all our pet enthusiasms merge into the background. It is the most important gift of the Holy Spirit of all." It's an important lesson, that, isn't it? I remember when I was a staff worker for the InterVarsity Fellowship, as it was then called, UCCF, as we know it now. I used to visit lots of universities in the southeast of England. And, well, I used to find that, broadly speaking, the Christians in them, the CU members, used to fit into one of several categories. They demonstrated different kinds of keenness, if you like. And I discovered you could usually tell which kind of keenness any particular individual represented by a quick look at their bookshelf. For instance, there were some who were what you might call charismatic keenies. They had lots and lots of books about spiritual gifts. If you ask them, "What's wrong with the Christian Union?" "Oh," they will say, "we're not filled with the Spirit." Or then there were what you might call Bible teaching keenies. When you looked at their bookshelf, it was full of Banner of Truth books and things like that. When you asked them, "What's wrong with the Christian Union?" they would say, "Oh, not enough sound teaching, definitely." Then there were always a few who were in the sort of social concern keeny movement. They would have books about third world poverty and Christian aid. When you ask them, "What's wrong with the CU?" "Oh, we're too inward-looking. We're not interested enough in third world issues." Then there would be some who would be, well, what you might call missionary keenies. They would have lots of missionary biography and books about evangelism and so on their bookshelf. And when you ask them, "What was wrong with the CU?" "Oh, well, there's not enough evangelism going on, is there?" Or then there would be the signs and wonders keeners. You ask them what was wrong with the CU, and they would say, "Well, we should be seeing far more healings than we are." And their bookshelf would be full of healings books and miracles books and so on. You think it's true? I mean, people do, don't they? Tend to have their enthusiasm in one or other of those areas. Well, all those opinions were represented at Corinth, too. It's quite clear from the first three verses, isn't it? The congregation was plagued there with rival emphases, rival spiritualities, all claiming to be superior to the other. "We're the really mature ones," some were saying. "We speak in tongues." They were the charismatic keenies for you. "Oh, that's nothing," said others. "Have you heard our Bible teacher? His sermons are riveting." The sound doctrine keeners. "Ah," said the others, "but does he work miracles? Signs and wonders are what the world really needs to see if it's going to believe, you know." Then there were others who advocated asceticism and self-denial, who wanted to give away all their money to the poor. There were still others who were so brave in their testimony they regarded martyrdom as the highest of all Christian ambitions. They were all there, you see, each eager to claim the highest place. Indeed, so intense had this internal quarreling become that the church was in danger of fragmentation into a whole host of sects, each one with its own party label, each one with its own denominational distinctive, each one with its own special leader that they lionized. Each one with its own pet enthusiasm. "Listen," says Paul. "You're all too keen that your group should have the limelight, that your distinctive should take the priority, that your enthusiasm should be recognized as the one above all others, Don't you realize, he says, without love, you are all a lot of nothing. Even if I can speak in the tongues of men and of angels, even if my gift of tongues is that elevated to be angelic, if I don't have love, why, I'm no better than one of those gongs or cymbals that they bang in the pagan temples to add to the atmosphere of religious excitement. It's all just a jarring jangle of noise. And no more than that. Without love. Oh, and you sound doctrine people who think that theological erudition and biblical knowledge is the be-all and end-all of spirituality. And you healers who are so keen to see miracle-working faith at work in the church all the time. And you social involvement fanatics who are concerned about third world poverty. And yes, even you would-be martyrs who think the greatest of all saints are the people who give their bodies to be burned. You are all overstating your case. For he says, all these things are a big zero without love. Are there not pagan gifts of tongues? Of course there are. Every Corinthian knew the gift of tongues was something that was recognized in pagan religions as well as in the Christian church. Are there not pagan miracles? Of course every Corinthian knew there were miracle workers by the thousand in the ancient world. Are there not pagan philosophers whose knowledge and exposition is spellbinding? Of course there were. Greece was full of them. Are there not pagan philanthropists who give their money away to the poor? Of course there are. Are there not pagan martyrs who are willing to die for their faith? Of course there are. None of these things is distinctively Christian. None of these things is indispensable to Christian spirituality. But love is. Love falls into a different category because love, he says, is the universal distinguishing hallmark of the Spirit of God. It is the mark of the Christian. Now, if you just look back to the end of chapter 12, you'll see how the flow of argument is going. In verse 29, he's saying, are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Do all work miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? And the anticipated answer to that Greek sentence every time is always no. None of these gifts is universal among Christians. There are varieties of gifts and talents and enthusiasms and emphases and endowments and ministries. But here's the point. Without love, I am nothing. See? A person can be a Christian and not be a preacher. A person can be a Christian and not be a healer. A person can be a Christian and not be a martyr. But a person cannot be a Christian and not be a lover. For without love, we are nothing. By this all men will know you are my disciples, said the Master. By your love. So says Paul, if you're going to have a supreme ambition for your Christian life and for your church, don't let it be speaking in tongues. It's not important enough. Don't let it even be sound theology. Even that isn't important enough. Don't let it even be being able to work miracles. Or espousing a simple lifestyle. Or even dying for the faith. If you want a supreme ambition for your life and your church, he says, make it love. For without love, I'm nothing. The trouble with love, of course, is that it's an abstract noun, isn't it? It's one of those buzzwords that has all kinds of connotation in our minds, but means so many different things to different people. Indeed, we ourselves use it in so many different contexts, don't we? I love my wife. I love bananas. Hopefully the two words are not quite the same in meaning in those two different contexts. What does Paul mean by this word, love? This abstract noun that means so many different things to so many different people, and which we use in such a variety of contexts. What does he really mean by it? Well, fortunately, Paul doesn't leave it as a buzzword, you see. In verse 4 and following, he goes on to amplify love, to explain to us, almost to define it. Henry Drummond, in his great classic sermon on this chapter, called The Greatest Thing in the World, compares verses 4 to 7 to the action of a crystal prism. He says Paul is refracting the white light of love into its component colors, so producing a spectrum of virtue, he says. All those virtues which are encapsulated within that overarching abstract noun of love. Patience, kindness, humility, courtesy, unselfishness, and so on. These are the spectral constituents of love. And I think in a very real sense, Drummond is absolutely right about that. Nowhere in the Bible do we come closer to a comprehensive definition of love than here, both in negative terms telling us what love is not, and positive terms telling us what love is. There's one thing, though, before we look at these verses in detail, I want you to notice, just by casting your eye down the list through this spectral analysis. If you look carefully at verses 4 to 7, I think you will see that there is not a sentimental word in the whole list. All these words that Paul uses to describe love are behavioral words, more really than they are emotional words. They're actions, not feelings. Virtues rather than passions. I think that's a very important general observation. See, the orbit of meaning of the word love in our vocabulary these days has been very controlled by its usage in relational terms between men and women. We use the word love so often in pop songs, don't we? I suspect the first idea that comes into any of our minds when we think of the word love is that kind of picture, a boy and a girl in love, which is a perfectly valid usage of the word, you see. But it could mislead us in understanding the word in this passage. It wasn't always so. There was a time, I think, when in English usage the word love was a much broader word with a very strong moral component. It was associated in people's minds with strong virtues like fidelity, unselfishness, and so on. But increasingly today, I think, love is being divorced from that ethical range of ideas. It no longer describes how I behave towards another person. For most people, I think, these days, the word love describes how I feel towards another person. It's a word of emotional dependency, perhaps. I love you means I need you. Or it's a word of sexual desire. I love you means I want you. Or it's a word of sentimental attachment. I love you means I'm fond of you. But in every case, it's feelings rather than actions that are in view, passions rather than virtues that are being expressed. Now that's a subtle change in emphasis in this word love, which very much influences, if we're not careful, our reading of the Bible. See, 9 times in our study passage, Paul uses this word, translated, in the New International Version anyway, that we've read from, as love. Well, what constellation of ideas gathers around your mind at the mention of that word? We're 20th century people, conditioned by 20th century culture, and so I suspect it's almost inevitable that that word love in our mind generates a whole host of basically sentimental associations. We jump to the conclusion when we hear that word love that Paul is talking about a way of feeling towards other people. But he is not, really. Oh, I am not saying, of course, that there's no element of affection or warmth in his use of this word love. Of course there is. But when Paul speaks of love here, that is quite obviously not the primary thing he's thinking about. Indeed, if he had been thinking primarily about feelings, There were two extremely common Greek words for love that would have conveyed that thought, eros and philia. Both of those Greek words in first century society were everyday words for love, in much the same way that our word for love is everyday. And yet Paul conspicuously avoids using them in this chapter. And I suspect for this very reason, that in those days, love was conceived basically in sentimental terms too. It was a feeling. Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 is not trying to describe a way of feeling. He's trying to describe a way of behaving. That's the meaning he's attributing to this word, love. Love for Paul is a moral word. Indeed, that's true of the whole New Testament. And that's why in the New Testament, Paul and the other apostles choose to use a rather rare and colorless, in fact, Greek word to describe love. Agape. A word which didn't have that sort of sentimental association, certainly, in people's minds in those days. Down through the years, Bible translators have tried to find some way to reproduce this vital choice of vocabulary in the apostles' language. When Jerome worked on the Vulgate version of the Bible in Latin, he avoided the obvious Latin word for love, amor, and chose instead to translate agape with the word caritas. He did that because he was a shrewd scholar, and he knew that amor had these same rather emotional rather than moral associations, I think. And he wanted to avoid them, for the same reason the Apostle Paul wants to avoid them in Greek society. When Wycliffe, in his English version, followed the Vulgate's lead, it translated 1 Corinthians 13 with the word charity from the Latin caritas. And that was subsequently adopted, of course, by the Authorized Version. And many of you who are familiar with the AV version of this will know. It uses the word charity throughout, rather than the word love. In many ways, it was a brilliant translation. But unfortunately, the word charity has today become too limited a word, having largely to do with collecting money for good causes. So our modern translators have wisely dropped it. But that unfortunately leaves us with no rendering for agape that really corresponds to Paul's original word. We're stuck with the word love. And with the consequent danger that we shall misunderstand what 1 Corinthians 13 is above, reading into that word all our late 20th century emotional, sentimental baggage. Learn first of all then tonight that love is not primarily warm feelings. If it were, how could God command us to love? Imperatives are out of place in our emotional life, aren't they? No one can command you to love somebody. You can't help how you feel. We fall in love, don't we? That's the way we talk about it, because that's how it feels. We didn't organize it for ourselves. We didn't make it for ourselves. It just happened, a bit like a hole in the road. You fall into it. And then, if you're lucky or unlucky, depending on your point of view, maybe you fall out of it. Equally unpredictable. For there's no predicting or controlling Cupid. He's a mischievous and arbitrary imp. We certainly can't be held responsible for his caprice. And that, of course, is why people find it so hard to promise to love, don't they? To stand in front of the minister and promise to love somebody till death us do part, impossible. It's ridiculous. I can't promise how I'm going to feel about somebody next week, let alone in 10 years' time or 40 years' time. You see, when Paul speaks of love, he's not referring to some passing emotional infatuation of the heart. He's talking about a commitment, a decision of the will, a love that has at its root not feelings, although feelings will be there, but not an emotional state. A moral commitment, a virtue, not a passion. Indeed, one of the ways, I think, of making it clear that that's what's in his mind is by recognizing that the way he describes love here very often has to do with how you behave in spite of your feelings. What Paul is describing in verses 4 to 7 is not how you feel, it's how you behave in spite of how you feel. Again and again, that's true. I mean, let me give you some examples. How does love, for instance, behave when it feels hurt by other people's injury. Now, Paul tells us negatively, he says, love is not easily angered. Love keeps no record of wrongs. Love is patient and kind. How do you respond to injury? There are two basic ways, aren't there? Some of us explode with rage. We get angry easily, as Paul says. We call it righteous anger, of course. But there's a good deal of unrighteous temper usually mixed in with it, isn't there? Or if we're not the explosive types who get angry easily, maybe we're the sort who nurse the grievance. The sulkers, you know? We hold on to that injury. We don't get angry, but inwardly we fume. That's what Paul's talking about when he talks here about keeping a record of wrongs. Counting up the evil, literally. Filing the injury away in our mental card index system. Sometimes you do this absolutely consciously, with the result that our attitude towards that other person is permanently irritable. Always say, that person makes me mad. Well, the truth is, of course, we don't have to be made mad by that person. We have a carefully accumulated store of irritation as far as that person is concerned, which is nurtured over the years, gathered out of diligently collected evils that we feel they've done, which we've held on to, and which are resurrected every time we meet them. But sometimes this hanging on to the injury is an unconscious process too, one we're not quite aware of. We hold hostility within us and bury it so deep that, as the psychiatrists say, it's repressed. We've bottled it up. It's left our conscious mind. But it still influences our behavior. That unresolved anger, it bubbles away in there like a kind of frozen state of rage in our subconscious. And it can have all kinds of damaging effects on us. Many counselors, of course, would say that depression very often arises in people as a result of that kind of frozen rage inside them. As far as Paul is concerned, it all comes down ultimately to a failure, to love. Love, he says, isn't easily angered. Neither does it keep a record of wrongs. On the contrary, he says, love is patient and kind. It's not difficult to see the relevance of this in that Corinthian situation, is it? Here they were all arguing with one another. It doesn't take any imagination to realize how, no doubt, some charismatic Christian with the gift of tongues in Corinth had upset some non-charismatic Christian in the church at Corinth, made them feel hurt. Well, says Paul, love isn't easily angered. Love keeps no record of wrongs. Love is patient and kind. Love's response to that injury is not to retaliate or to sulk. It is to care for the person. To take a deliberate decision, to be more caring towards that person precisely because you feel angry. You feel upset. That's what it means, he says, to love them. It's not about how you feel. It's about how you behave, sometimes in spite of your feelings. Get the point? Let me give you another example. How does love behave when we feel disadvantaged by other people's superiorities? Paul says that in one word here. Love, he says, does not envy. You must have been in a situation where you were faced by somebody who was very, very, very good at something that you wished you were good at. Might be playing the piano. Might be passing exams. How do we feel when we meet the person who's the business success we always wanted to be but never were? How do we feel when we meet the person who's got a doctorate and we fail to get a GCSE? How does the single girl feel when she hears her next door neighbour has just got engaged to a good-looking millionaire? How does the infertile woman feel when she hears her next-door neighbor is just pregnant? Yet again. How do I feel when I hear somebody who can preach better than I can? Well, I tell you how we feel, don't we? We feel envious, jealous. That's the word we normally use. That's not quite really a strict usage of the word. Green-eyed envy. That's a natural reaction when you're confronted by superiority in somebody else because your ego is threatened by them. Their gifts and abilities make you feel inadequate. How do you defend your ego? Well, all too often, of course, we do it by picking holes, don't we? Finding fault. Slinging a little mud. We want to bring them down a peg or two. You know that old saying, if you want to find a person's faults, praise him to his friends. They'll tell you very quickly. You try it. But sometimes, of course, once again, this envy is not a conscious response. It's a subconscious one. We don't admit how we feel to ourselves. We may even adopt a sort of sycophantic, fawning attitude to the person concerned. But deep down, that sense of humiliation eats away at our self-esteem. So we feel inadequate. We get an inferiority complex. I'm no use at anything, we say. Can't you see that fellow at Corinth feeling utterly demoralized because somebody else has some spiritual gift which he hasn't got? And everybody thinks it's a marvelous gift, and they ooh and they are about how wonderful this person is. And there they are feeling completely out of it. How's he handling that feeling? Is he sniping at the spiritually gifted person? Snide whispers in the back row of the pew every time he stands up to speak? Or is he wallowing in self-pity? Sitting in the pastor's office, telling the pastor he's really no good as a Christian. At the end of the day, you see, it's just envy. We're not content with who we are. We want to be somebody else. At its root, says Paul, it's a failure to love. For love finds another way to deal with the superiority of others. Love does not allow this threatened ego to get the better of it. Love can rejoice in the gifts of others. It can admire without resentment. It can praise without cynicism. For love, he says, refuses to be envious. See what again I mean when I say it's not so much a matter of how you feel, but of how you behave sometimes in spite of your feelings. Get another example from these verses. How does love behave when we feel we are the superior ones? Now that's a much nicer position to be in, isn't it? Paul tells us how love behaves in that situation. Love does not boast, he says. It is not proud, and it is not rude. Now, that's an interesting collection of three words. The word boast was a word that was used a lot by the Stoic philosophers in the New Testament times, and it describes a sort of bragging attitude of people who think they are intellectually superior. Now, we've all come across that in Cambridge, haven't we? And proud, well, proud literally means inflated, puffed up, puffed up. We might translate it more idiomatically, puts on airs. This person doesn't necessarily actually have any superiority, but they like to pretend they do. Maybe they're a windbag, as we would say. But they love the limelight. They love to be exhibitionist. It was often used of the swaggering rhetoric of the philosopher in the marketplace, who didn't really have any good ideas, but loved to parade what he did know. And that third word, rude, now that perhaps is the most interesting one of all, because strictly speaking, it means to behave dishonorably. It was sometimes used of flirtatiousness in a sexual sense. But perhaps more generally, it was used of manipulative or insincere speech. I wonder if Paul has in mind some of these elitist Christians in Corinth, demonstrating their vanity by condescending, sarcastic flattery. You know the sort of thing I mean? "Oh, what a wonderful dress, my dear. Suits you so well. Did it take you long to make it?" You know that sort of thing? There's an old proverb in English which says, "You tell a true gentleman not by how he behaves towards the king, but by how he behaves towards his maid servant." A lot of wisdom in that. We all find it easy to be obsequious and polite in the presence of our superiors, but that's just enlightened self-interest. The point about love is it is just as humble, just as courteous in its behavior towards those to whom we owe no such debt of respect, humanly speaking. This is a word, then, for those who are gifted and admired in the congregation, those who find they are the center of attention. Love does not boast, he says. It does not put on airs. It is not rude towards others who are less prominent. Once again, it's a way of behaving, you see, more than a way of feeling. I'll give you yet another example. How does love behave when you feel contradicted by other people? That, I think, is what Paul is getting at when he says there, love is not self-seeking. Or as the old RSV translated, love does not insist on its own way. I think that's exactly what he's getting at. Love does not insist on its own way. Do you know that Peanuts cartoon? I think it's the little girl. What's her name? Lucy. She says, "Charlie Brown, you're being obstinate." "I'm not," replies Charlie Brown. "Yes, you are," she says. "You're being very obstinate." "I tell you I'm not," he says again. "Well, then what are you being?" "I am merely being tenacious," replies Charlie Brown. That's something you can do with the English language, isn't it? Turn a vice into a virtue, just by the use of the dictionary. We conceal our egotism behind a cloak of words like tenacity, determination, resolution, single-mindedness. But where do those virtues stop and the vices of obstinacy and bigotry and pig-headedness begin? The boundary can be very obscure, wouldn't you agree? Paul will tell us. The virtues stop when the love stops. When people start taking second place to my ambition. When I am no longer insisting on the right way, but just insisting on my way. Of course, it's rather contrary, isn't it, to the spirit of our modern competitive individualism to give in situations. Often regarded as a sign of weakness, isn't it? If you're going to be a strong person whom Margaret Thatcher would admire, you must be a determined individual who knows how to get their own way, stands by their principles and all that. But of course, that isn't always the case, is it? Sometimes it's the person who is feeling threatened and insecure, the person who actually inside does not feel at all sure of himself, who somehow has to prove himself to himself by showing everybody else who's boss. Isn't that right? It's often the insecure person who can't give way over an issue rather than the secure person. It's so in a marriage, of course. It's the weak husband who never gives way to his wife, not the strong husband, isn't it? You'd all agree with that, wouldn't you? It's certainly so in a business, isn't it? It's the weak manager, not the strong manager, who can never accept the initiative or advice of his junior. And it's certainly so in the church. It's the person who's behind in their spiritual growth, who feels insecure in their relationship with God and with other Christians, who is forever banging on the pastor's desk and demanding this or that. Love does not insist on its own way, says Paul. course, we feel contradicted sometimes. We feel opposition. We feel other people trying to stop us doing what we want to do. That was clearly happening in Corinth. There were the charismatics over there who wanted to turn the whole thing into a charismatic rave-up, and there were the non-charismatics over there who wanted to turn the whole thing into a theological college. Never the two would meet. Love does not insist on its own way, says Paul. Once again, it's a matter of how you behave, often in spite of your feelings. One more example. How does love react to feelings of moral outrage? Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. There are all kinds of ways, of course, of rejoicing at evil. One way is salaciousness. The gossip who is forever reciting the spicy scandal of others' shame, who feigns shocked indignation, maybe, but privately revels in the vulgar delight of it all. That's one way of rejoicing in evil. Another way, I suspect, of rejoicing in evil is suspiciousness. You know, the Othello, who's always willing to assume the worst about other people. Maybe he thinks he's being noble and upright, but actually he's just a paranoiac who's revealing how insecure and spoilt he is. And then, of course, there's the prudishness, isn't there? The censoriousness that tut-tuts at sordid stories in the Sunday newspapers, though it always makes sure to get their copy. That shuns the company of permissive, immoral people down the street, but secretly gets a huge personal satisfaction from all this pharisaical, self-righteous posturing. Now, says Paul, there's no room for any of that in love. Love is not on the lookout for sin. It gets no satisfaction from other people's sin. I have no doubt that those rival parties in Corinth tried to smear one another. If there was an example of sin in the members of one of those groups, oh, the others would make the most of that. Well, he's one of those American evangelists, isn't he? They're all the same, you know. Well, he's a charismatic, isn't he? They're all the same, you know. Well, he's reformed. They're all the same, you know. Typical of that. Typical. See? How they exploited such scandal for their own devices. But says Paul, love never takes that attitude. Love is always looking for positive things to say about other people. It's looking for success to applaud. It's looking for virtue to compliment. Has no interest at all in running other people down, pointing out their faults, no matter who they are. It does not rejoice. It does not delight in evil. On the contrary, he says, there is an integrity about love's jubilation. It rejoices with the truth. That's what he means. There's an integrity about love's jubilation. Just one more example from this spectral analysis. How does love react to feelings of disappointment? How does love behave when the people we love let us down? Paul ends with this in verse 7. Love, he says, always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. There is a good deal of cynicism about love in our world today, isn't there? An awful lot of people who have invested love in others and found they have been disappointed. I'll not get hurt again, they say. Where love is concerned, it's safer to be a taker than a giver. It's easy to understand that when you think of love as a feeling. No one wants their feelings hurt. But Paul is not talking about a feeling here. He's talking about a virtue, a moral commitment. He says, the love I'm talking about has a persistent optimism about it, a durable loyalty. Inevitably, sometimes people let us down. Our best hopes are shattered. We thought they were dependable, and now they've proven broken reeds. And it's easy then to give way to defeatism and despondency. But says Paul, love is never put off by rebuffs, never demoralized by disappointments. It never gives up in that way. It always protects, it always trusts, it always hopes, it always perseveres. Love, he says, never fails. Perhaps it's here more than anywhere else that Paul is pointing up to us the difference between love as he's talking about it and the kind of ideas of love that we perhaps conventionally have. For the world has its ideas of love, of course. Love founded on need, like a child for a parent. Or love founded on respect, like a son for a father. Or love founded on sex, like a man for a woman. Or love founded on affection, like two friends. But all those sort of worldly loves are based on feelings and therefore depend for some stimulus, don't they? Something in the object of our love which makes us want to love them. Some attraction, some magnetism, some dependency. Whether physical or emotional, it's something that fosters the love and draws it out of us. And that's why the world's love is such a romantic vapor of the emotions, why it can be so ephemeral, blown away so quickly. Because if the stimulus fails, so does the love. But Paul is talking here about a love that does not evaporate like that. A love that bears all things and endures all things. For you see, Paul is talking here not about ordinary human loves. He's talking about the divine love. That's the most important reason he chose this word agape. It was the word that the Jews had decided they would use when they spoke of the love which God has for men and women. And it's that same word, the divine love, which Paul predicates here of Christians. The most fundamental thing about the way God loves is that his love does not depend on some attractiveness in the object. And you know that. God does not love us because he finds us attractive. On the contrary, we are sinners and he hates sin. There are huge things about every one of us that God detests because we are morally broken and offensive in his sight. Yet he loves us and he is determined to go on loving us. Shakespeare said, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, doesn't he? Maybe he should have said more accurately, love is not the divine love which alters when it alteration finds. For our human loves are all too susceptible to change. But this agape, this divine love, it goes on loving and goes on loving, even as Jesus Christ goes on loving you, some of you, in spite of the fact that you are turning your back on him yet again. That's the way he loves. It is his characteristic. It was the issue of spiritual gifts, remember, that sparked off Paul on this eulogy of love. He wanted to show people that as important as charismatic gifts are, love is more important. He returns to that, you see, in verses 8 and following. Love is the gift, he says, that outlasts all those other gifts you're so fond of. Tongues and prophecy and knowledge, all these gifts which you Corinthians are getting excited about, they're provisional, he says. They're temporary. A day will come when they just won't exist anymore. Why? Because they don't adhere in the character of God. Why, he says, when we get to heaven, when perfection comes, when the day dawns and the shadows disappear, when we see God face to face and are known by him and know him with the same degree of vividness that he knows us, when that wonderful day comes, he says, we shan't be interested in tongues or prophecy or knowledge. Such gifts will have lost their utility. You see these two pictures he uses to compare the way things are now with the way things will be then. The first is the transition from childhood to adult maturity. When I was a child, he says, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Well, he says, when we go to heaven, when we meet God face to face, it will be like becoming an adult after years of infancy. It's fun, rather, isn't it, listening to children speak? Listening to them trying to put their mouths around words. I always find it amusing to reflect that even the greatest preachers that I might admire, you know, people like John Stott, once sat in a cradle going da 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 da. And what about a child's reasoning? That can be pretty shattering, can't it? Like that story of the little boy who was painting a picture in school. And the teacher who'd done her training at Homerton wisely said, "Tell me about it." "I'm painting a picture of God," said the little boy. "Don't be silly," said the teacher, immediately forgetting her training. "Nobody knows what God looks like. That's why I'm painting the picture." Now, do you see the sort of theological arrogance that we have down here and the sort of spiritual baby talk that we talk down here will embarrass us when we stand adult in heaven and remember how we spoke and how proud we were of our infantile grasps of doctrine. We are like children. Our gifts of utterance and knowledge are no more than childish toys that one day, says Paul, we will grow out of. If there are prophecies, they will cease. If there are tongues, they will be stilled. If there is knowledge, it will pass away. We know in part. We prophesy in part. He uses this picture again, doesn't he, of the mirror in verse 12 to make exactly that point. In the ancient world, of course, mirrors were made of either very poor glass or mica, which was even worse. All you could see in them was a very distorted image. And even if it was good glass, of course, all you got was an indirect image. You know, those of you who are drivers, that there's a blind spot in every driver's mirror. Not in the same way, says Paul. We do not yet know. All we have are distorted pictures and blind spots. When the perfect comes, all our pretentious quest for truth will look like the feeble groping of a man, I don't know, trying to shave in a misty mirror, or trying to drive with the windscreen wipers broken through heavy rain. We know in part. We see in part. Then, face to face. Then, fully. "Even as I am fully known," he says. I don't care how deep an experience of the Holy Spirit you've had. I don't care how many times you feel you've been filled with the Holy Spirit, how many gifts of the Holy Spirit you feel you've received. I don't care how many theological books you think you've read, how well you feel you've mastered the Christian message. I don't care how many hours a day you spend in prayer, or how deep your relationship with God goes in your own estimation. You have not yet arrived. We know in part. We're on the journey. But there is a not yet in our experience, and it's much bigger than most of us realize. Says Paul, there's only one thing, therefore, that you and I can invest in, which will really be an investment in eternity. And that's love. The gifts we make a lot of in the church today, he says, will pass away, and for that very reason, the value we set on them must be limited. But this love I'm talking about, he says, is a divine virtue. It adheres in the very character of God himself. And when we display it, we are reflecting his image. Love, then, is the currency of heaven. It's the gold that never devalues. Love, he says, abides. There are only a handful of things, he says, in this world, of which that is true. Faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of them, he says, is love. What do you think makes Eden Baptist Church like heaven? Well, it's not the speaking in tongues, because we don't have much of that here, do we? And, well, we have plenty of theological education in our education classes, but it's not that either. Do you know in heaven, there'll be absolutely zero demand for the Eden Baptist Church tape catalogue, too? Now, what makes Eden Baptist Church like heaven is the love you find here. Heaven is a world of love. When the shadows disappear, together with the books and the divisions and the mistrust that separate brothers and sisters in Christ, it will be the love that we've been enabled to demonstrate to one another, often in spite of our feelings, that will last. Maybe you're saying to me, well, this is all very fine, Roy. This all sounds great. And I would certainly like to live a life of love like that. But it's a tall order, isn't it? If I'm honest with myself, though I can give mental assent in a church like this on a Sunday night, to how nice it would be if I loved people, behaved lovingly towards them, overcome my negative feelings, and demonstrated this generosity of spirit, this unselfishness that Paul is requiring here. I can see that would make the church so much happier. It would make me so much happier. It would make those I mix with so much happier. It would make the world so much a better place. And more important than all that, it would please God more than anything else. But Roy, I can't do it. I've tried before. I've listened to sermons like this before, Roy. It's all finished by Tuesday afternoon. A former Archbishop of Canterbury put it like this. He said, it's no good telling me to write a play like Hamlet. Shakespeare could do that. I can't. And it's no good telling me to love people the way Jesus did. Jesus could do it. I can't. True. But that Archbishop of Canterbury went on a little further. He said, but if the spirit of Shakespeare could somehow come and live inside me, maybe I could write a play like Hamlet. And if the spirit of Jesus could somehow come and dwell within me, maybe I could love like Jesus. That's the miracle the New Testament is talking about. If you have heard me tonight saying, I want you to go out of this place and whip yourself up into a moral fervor of loving people, then you've heard me wrong. In fact, you've forgotten the whole of that first half hour. This is Pentecost Sunday. Yes, love is a moral virtue. Yes, love is a command. But because Pentecost has come, it is also a gift.